Thank you very much, Lynn Curtis, for having me here at the Commonwealth Club. And it's great having an audience. Thank you. So good to see everybody tonight. So I'm going to hit on a number of topics tonight, mainly about my experience in Afghanistan, and also the photographs that I somehow managed to take during my 15-month deployment. Now, a lot of them, I'm going to go into kind of my past from when I lived in Arizona before the Army, when I was going to film school, and my botched attempt at graphic design as well. So basically, that is my influence with these photos. But again, I can talk about how I took these photos, as well as the living conditions in Afghanistan, also kind of the face or the lack thereof of the enemy. It's like in Afghanistan, you really have no clue who's fighting against you and who's fighting with you. So basically, I'm going to hit on that, and also kind of the return home portion and what I'm doing now. And I work for the VA right now on the counseling side of the house, and basically treating returning veterans and veterans of all combat theaters suffering from PTSD. So me personally, giving back to my fellow soldier, airman, marine, etc. So really happy about giving back. And shoot, going to kind of lead into a slideshow. And like I said, it's better to have kind of a conversation with the audience. So if anything comes up and you guys can't catch any of the lingo, just raise your hand, kind of sound off, and we'll get that question answered. And like Lynn said, basically my deployment started in February 2005. Just to kind of give you an overview, and hopefully you guys could see it well enough, my deployment started around Kabul, this area region of northeastern Afghanistan. For the first 3 months of that deployment, it was basically like any deployment. You're waiting for your stuff to arrive. You're waiting to receive your mission. And the beginning part of our mission that lasted for about 4 months was counterinsurgency. Go find the bad guys. Seek, strike, and destroy. That was our motto. So we were up in the mountains the first portion, 3 months into it. And I had a question already asked. What was it like for your NCOs? What do they say, you know, your Iraq veterans? What was that like to be in Afghanistan? And once we hit those mountains, they were wishing they were in Iraq again. And that's another portion I'm going to hit, too, is the living conditions. And hopefully a few of these photos actually shed light on that as well. Kind of bringing this to my attention to the visual aid. Like I said, started here for about 3 months. And being a 19 Delta, basically, is you want to think of it as armored infantry. Basically, we were light infantry, so we were in Humvees everywhere we went. So we had the option of moving. You know, we used helicopters, but mainly our main mode of transportation was Humvees. Like I said, started here, more central Afghanistan, or northeastern, excuse me, traveled all the way to northeastern Afghanistan to a special forces outpost. From there, we got orders to go all the way down to Kandahar, which I was on R&R for that one, so I didn't get to experience that, the fighting in Musa Kale. Then after that, for the last leg, kind of an overview where a lot of the pictures are going to be taken from is northeastern Afghanistan. And kind of touching on that, that's a region where no Americans will be anymore. Petraeus, the U.S. military basically shifted their focus from these remote areas in Afghanistan to centralized areas. So the work that my unit did for about 1 year, 173rd replaced us. They had heavy casualties for about 15 months. And also they were replaced by 4th Infantry Division, all cavalry units in this remote region up in the Hindu Kush Mountains, basically was abandoned last year. And 2 days before they were about to leave or abandon this outpost, they were practically overran by close to 300 insurgents. So I believe 8 U.S. force or U.S. soldiers were killed during that one incident. So this whole area, Kamdish, Afghanistan, this is in Nuristan province. There's not going to be any photos coming out of that region anymore due to the strategy shift. And that's going to lead me into my photos. Yes, ma'am? I wouldn't call it a waste of time, but really, and I'm going to kind of end on that note, kind of like my transition and all the hard work that we did. I mean, when I got out of the military, kind of jumping a little forward, I paid attention to Afghanistan. I cared what was going on, especially in the region that I was at. And to hear northeastern Afghanistan Nuristan province, I knew that was the base that I established, or my unit established. So to kind of hear that, you know, that really kind of hits you in the gut, all that hard work, and especially the amount of casualties we had out there, whether wounded or killed in action, you know, you start to, you know, wonder for what, you know. And this is someone that was personally touched by this terrain, by the people, by that whole experience out there. So, and kind of talking about the publication side of the house, basically, I started out in graphic design in film school. So my base is a film junkie, watching movies. You know, I started off with the main movie that started all these photos, and I could thank Tarantino for this one, was watching Reservoir Dogs when I was 14 years old. So after that, I saw Pulp Fiction, and then I was hooked. So one thing I would do, I would not pay attention to the acting, the lighting, nothing. So basically, it was about camera movement. So then I started looking for Kurosawa, you know, Scorsese. My goodness. I could just start laying off a big list of movies and filmmakers, but that was my focus. So when I took my camera overseas, I only came there with one intention, to transfer the video skills that I picked up shooting 8mm film. That was rough. And transferring that into a still film. So I cut all the overhead. Very happy about that. And shooting digital, too, I had more room to move. So once I returned in, actually have it with me, give me one second. Once I returned in July 2007, I always kept this little piece of paper in my breast pocket. So once I returned, now this is a little cutout from National Geographic, Your Shot, and I'm like, how cool would that be to be in National Geographic? So always carry this with me. It never got saturated. I never lost it. So once I came back, started putting my stuff online, and then someone picked it up, someone published it, and then sure as day, I'm trying to blend in with my peers in college, and then I have a boom mic resting over my head from a National Geographic film crew. So, and just like tonight, I mean, this has been an amazing welcome home for me. So my journey... say again, sir?
What is it?
Yeah, this National Geographic Your Shot. So it's like, hey, you got any amateur photos? Give them to us. Maybe we'll get published. And sure as day, I don't know, very happy. And like I said, this camera, it was a great way to transfer, you know, not only my own story, but the story that my guys went through as well. So now I'm here, hopefully doing a good job speaking on their behalf as well. So basically, I don't want to keep these slides up too long. My leg started Fort Drum, New York, February 12th, 2006. And this is our one-way ticket to Afghanistan. This is leaving the tarmac from Fort Drum, New York. So basically, I was going there with the intention of actually starting a photo essay. I'm like, hey, you know, and I got in trouble for taking this photo as well. But just taking photos, and this is where I start the journey. Yes, sir?
Can you sort of address that, you know, as you go along? It's like, is there a review process, or for all these, are you able to just do this without having any...
Yeah, and that's a common question. More censorship, sure?
Yeah.
Okay. A thing about censorship, and that's one of my last photos, one of my last notes. Basically... we had a helicopter crash that happened May 5th, 2006. We lost our lieutenant colonel, which he could have skipped out of that mission. He wanted to pull his guys off, the last guys that were on this mountaintop, bring them back home. Instead, helicopter crashed, killed him. He never got to see his baby. And we also lost three other members of our cavalry troop. So... I took my camera. I respected everybody. You know, they said their goodbyes at the memorial ceremony. You'll see with, like, the boots and the helmet and everything. Respected everybody. And the last person, one of his dear friends, a lieutenant colonel, he was paying respect, got that one photo. And then a couple weeks later, it was already at brigade level that we were already, like, starting to see this. And they were actually printing these off and making posters out of them. After that, that one experience of actually kind of proving myself, it was game on, more of a free-for-all. So basically, the only person or power that was limiting me, it was myself. And there were a few occasions I just didn't see the need to do it, especially people that were deceased. And this photo right here, this is, I guess, the most popular. This eventually ended in the pages of National Geographic. the little thing that I had in my breast pocket, and it ended up turning out pretty well. And that was just awesome to see it, just being able to be a photographer. You see your print actually in print. You know, you're able to hold that piece of paper instead of it being just a digital file. And just to see that, I mean, then after that, with the National Geographic, they sent out a film crew based on this photo. So, like I said, heck of a homecoming. I believe it was March 2008, sir. It has a dog on the front. Yes, sir? No, not at all. But I knew I had something, and a lot of these photos too, sir. A thing about photography. Do we have any photographers in here? Anybody?
I was thinking, man, I mean, what a competition.
Yeah, and thank you. Thank you. Yeah, probably a small crop, and I think I had it overexposed, but pretty much that's it. And also, it was about seeing the image. That's why I asked if you have any photographers. It's about seeing the image first. First of all, you have to have the story. Seeing the image, and then the camera is just kind of secondary. And this is just the first time I ever had kind of a telephoto shot. A lot of them are pretty up close. You know, I'm able to get my composition. You should see the photo of me. Moments before I took this, just miserable. I had in my helmet, oh my goodness, 9 months worth of sweat that built up to just dirt that was going down over my glasses. So just to see this horrible look, and you know, maybe that might have been the mirror of what I was looking at. So basically zoomed in, saw that look, and snapped. And within a 3 week time period, taking this photo, I had two things published with Nat Geo. Yeah. So that's kind of the end of this result. Get a nice email. They're trying to get the captions right. I'm like, what, are you serious? This is amazing, you know. But, you know, it's user submission. I could go into a big, long, winded conversation about photography, my experience with it. But, I mean, talk about, like I said, heck of a homecoming. And this is another photo. As soon as I got back, thought it was awesome. Kind of the screen doesn't really, yeah, there we go. But really kind of messing around a lot of this stuff too. I did not have time to do this stuff manually. You know, auto setting, the lighting was right, and it caught it. And I'm actually looking at this small LCD screen from this Canon Rebel, and just kind of looking at my work on this little screen, and like, I think I got something here. And then as soon as I got back, they made a wallpaper out of it. So if you want to put that on your desktop when you get back. And another thing, too, it was about another common question. It's like, so what did the Afghanis, how did they feel when you were taking pictures of them? You know, a lot of them pass off as real tough. And right here, it just worked out great. I was bored. I was living in a foxhole, and this is the first snow of the year. So I'm like, hey, I'm not doing anything. I'm not on guard. I'll walk around the post, hopefully not get my camera wet. And these gentlemen are constructing, and this is a part of our mission, is to build the economy of Nuristan. We're supposed to bring them jobs. We're supposed to bring them a part of the Afghan government because they saw themselves as more Pakistani or more Nuristani than Afghani. They had nothing to do with the government at all. We came in there. We tried to provide jobs. But getting back to that first point, you know, I turned that camera around, showed on that LCD, and the biggest smiles. I mean, same thing with the kids, too. You'll see a lot of photos where a lot of tough kids. Then came back, got that honorable mention, 2007 International Photo Contest. So just kind of, yes, sir?
That's one of my favorite photos of the entire exhibition. Did you just take that spontaneously, or?
No, it was walking around. They didn't care that I was in there, and they were constructing a building. So, and also it was just looking at like the characters and just all of them, they just had a look to them. And I think this guy's wearing like a Russian tanker helmet, something like that. But just kind of looking at that detail, and I'm walking around and I try and set them up in a portrait. And then instead they kind of line up in a kind of a horseshoe. The guy starts staring at me. Instead of kind of getting like this straight on view, actually being creative. And then there's this guy just moving in and out, trying to get that right angle on my camera. And it came out. And like I said, turned the camera around on them, big smiles from everybody, and they went back to work. Now, this is getting more into the living conditions, I believe. I just organized this in the preview. Hope it works out. So basically, I'm going to be covering the last leg of our deployment for the last year. This is in northeastern Afghanistan, the portion we no longer have any forces there whatsoever. Basically, remote. We were the first people out there. My first encounter with this area after driving, probably 10 hours, you know, going 15 miles an hour during this one road in and out. And that's another thing I want to kind of hit again with the living conditions. We drove next to it. It was right next to a river. And we drove next to three Russian armored personnel carriers. And I guess this is as far as the advance went with the Russians. So those armored personnel carriers were turned into park benches. So you're driving past a little piece of history right there. At least that was my observation, and later got some good photos out of that. And how we were resupplied, this is later. So basically, we couldn't walk anywhere, and this is on top of a mountain. So we had all of our resupplies, and this is a part of the reason why my camera broke as well, was standing behind a thing of supplies, firewood, food, etc., and getting beat to death by the exhaust of that Chinook. But we were in so remote, that's how we would do all of our major combat missions, was air assault and also getting food resupplies. And this is during the hot and heavy portion of Afghanistan. Like I said, going to the photography portion of it, like it was always soldier first. Now, if I had no role, which I didn't most of the time, then we were sitting on top of a mountain. We have an ambush in the valley below. And just taking into consideration, it's one road surrounded by mountains, 800 feet tall. So the enemy has the complete tactical advantage. You have nowhere to turn. Basically, you're one road in and out. And God forbid a vehicle gets disabled or you're in a bad spot. And this is basically fire support from our mortar team that was on top of that observation post on the top of a mountain. And like I said, using those low-angle dolly shots that I love so much in the movies, you know, I'm sitting there during an actual fire mission somehow capturing these foments. And basically, chaos, hearing people scream on the radio, the mortars firing as well, and, you know, what better to do than just take pictures? Kind of helpless, yeah. Well, this right here, they had a mortar team of three guys. They were operating. Everybody else is sitting on a radio. People were smoking. People were joking. That's it. So what am I doing? I'm not sitting around a radio. Get to the action. Start taking my photos. And I'm looking at it, too. What would build a really good photo essay? And I was just trying to do this. I'm like, can I actually capture this? You know, even if, you know, this mud was a beautiful surprise, because this is after 20 minutes of firing mortars. And just like the movies, the mortar tube heats up. They got to pour water on it, and it had a nice effect. You know, as for them, one case in particular, everybody else was fine with it. They got some good HUA photos. They could show their girlfriend or friends back home. But it's actually the picture of Westbrook, and that's the gentleman that I'll show you a couple pictures of him wounded. That right there, I'll touch on in a second. Now, talking about the combat, best way to describe it, like I said, it was one road. You had your main base in the valley floor, one road in and out, and you were surrounded by mountains. The enemy had the complete tactical advantage, and basically we were shooting ducks every time we drove down the road. It started with 5 to 10-man elements shooting at us, pop shots with AK-47s. It switched to recoilless rifles, RPGs, and then I was the first person in my CAV squadron to get hit with an IED, okay? So it just got worse and worse and worse and worse. And it was just like, this is crazy. I can't believe that it went from absolutely nothing the first 6 months to coming to this and complete madness. In this photo, this is a picture of Bravo Troop, one of the drivers. This right here, a direct shot to his front windshield. And this is a round bigger than a 7.62, so just a common AK-47 rifle round. This right here is an RPG bouncing off the side of our truck. His truck. So the armor completely kept us safe, but there was also a particular incident where that armor, they hit it with a different type of RPG round, went through the side portion of the vehicle. It's a very vulnerable seam. And I think blew one guy's arm off and shrapneled everybody else. So I think they had four or five Purple Hearts that one day just in that truck alone. And real quick, they don't allow Humvees on the road anymore. In Afghanistan, you're going to see the big MRAPs, the big mine-resistant vehicles. This right here is an example of us not having proper equipment. Okay, the armor helped. It stopped a lot of bullets. I mean, I can speak firsthand about, you know, bullets ricocheting off my vehicle. IED hit the front part of my vehicle, only hit some of the engine lighting underneath the hood. But this right here, with the enemy having a tactical advantage, or the insurgency having the tactical advantage, basically they were shooting down on our gunners with no overhead protection. So we had all of our gunners in my platoon Purple Heart recipients. And this picture of Westbrook, getting to that point, sir, he got his bottom portion of his hand ripped off by RPG shrapnel, hit his neck. If it wasn't for his throat guard right here, basically he would have been killed, which is shrapnel to his neck. And there's a lot of resentment for this photo. Like I said, was I being greedy by taking a lot of these photos? Was I trying to get this really who was shot? I wasn't trying to make these awesome Army photos. I was trying to tell the truth. And this is another portion. Like I said, I always had my camera connected to my vest, took it out. This is during a firefight. Laid down two magazines, just shot up blind into a mountain like I was in a hidden thing. Turned around as I was pulling security as a medevac bird was coming in and took photos. You know? Yes, sir?
I don't know much about photography, but how big was your camera? Something that I don't know.
It was a Canon Rebel, so a small lens you could pull focus with. In a pretty small body too, and the thing took a beating. But yeah, there's still a lot of resentment for that photo, especially like I said, I'm presenting a story tonight, and this is also me kind of talking about photojournalism too. You're doing it at someone else's expense. So me personally doing documentary, yes sir, from Westbrook, Jason Westbrook, yeah. But yes sir.
Well, one thing.
Yeah, and you know, he has not too many soldiers, and I've seen a lot of work coming out of Afghanistan. They have to ask for permission to get those photos of them wounded. They have to, I guess, they sign a waiver. I think they have to sign a waiver now, but then have pictures of them taken wounded, okay? Like I said, took pictures of him wounded, gave him copies. You know, there's not a lot of people out there that have a journalist embedded with them or someone with a camera to capture that day. And I can honestly tell you that's probably the worst day of his life. And kind of dealing that, and kind of like I said, me trying to get into the photojournalism world, I'm doing it, you know, hopefully as an artist, as a documented photographer, but at someone else's expense. You know, you could be a storyteller, but at the same time, it's that fine line between, not exploitation, I don't want to say that, you know, but at the same time, that's something that I have to kind of deal with personally. Oh, yeah, he is. I think that's how it was. And, like, once we came back, there was a seventh-month gap from the time that we saw him, you know, wounded, to where we saw him back at Fort Drum, and completely different person. You know, he had a personality to him. He was a good guy and completely distant. Had nothing want anybody to do with you. He was doing surgeries at Walter Reed and gave him pictures. I'm like, hey, man, there you go. Look at this, you know. It was talking to him when I was getting stuff published. That's when, and take in mind, this is when he was getting hit with his second batch of morphine in his neck. So he could have been seeing things a little bit different, but it was a different story than what actually happened. And kind of hearing that side of his story, what he thinks what happened, like I said, some one-liner, and I took these photos. No, no. But for him to say that, like I said, that kind of weighs heavy on me. So this is a picture of Specialist Darrell. He's still in the military. He's providing aid to Westbrook, raising his hand, got him bandaged up, got kind of some neck gauze and everything on him. And like I said, sitting in the driver's seat waiting for him to get medevaced, and I saw this nice touching picture, you know, the brotherhood, the camaraderie. And like I said, this is another picture of a fire mission going on. We had two mortar systems going on at once. One was firing, the other one was firing. And basically, I had no role. You know, it was always soldier first, like I said, and I wanted to really stress that. So just kind of captured this dramatic image. And going back to how severe this area was, going back to journalism, we saw we had a reporter from Salon Magazine. We had two photographers. One of the photographers was actually shot when he was out there with us. Other than that, there was no coverage, you know. And once I came back, kind of my homecoming was, oh, you were only in Afghanistan? You know, what's that about? And to know what I went through, there's no way I could really tell it other than, you know, getting in some sort of, you know, argument with him, whatever. No point in that. But just kind of stressing, in this photo alone, we had three people killed. One U.S. National Guard soldier, he was training the Afghan army, shot in the neck when they started bringing snipers out there. He was shot in the throat, and two Afghan army soldiers was killed. And this is kind of a gurney team trying to wait for him to come inside the gate and get a medevac. Now, kind of getting into the Afghan National Army, that was our counterpart. You know, a different degree of soldier. I'm not going to say they were the best caliber of soldiers. This is probably the best right here. This is a pair of Afghan National Army soldiers, okay? Now, the only way, and this is a black and white photo, but the only way you could tell that they're friendly, okay, they're walking around with AK-47s, RPGs, was this pink hat that was probably hard to find somewhere. So my dad calls this the Pink Panthers, you know. He likes to label or name his own photos. But this right here, just pause for a minute. And this is actually when I was the reconnaissance photographs. I was pictures of roads and, you know, just small stuff like that. So at the beginning, I kind of weaseled my way to take photos, being the reconnaissance photo. And this is one of the examples right here. And seeing this image and kind of snapping away at it. Yes, sir?
So I read your caption that, you know, these two people were special forces, right?
Yeah.
And I just looked at their paper.
Yeah.
It's just like kind of really like what I would have special forces.
Yeah, and they actually have a different batch. This is a team, and I'm pretty sure they were SF because they were working with an ODA team, an SF team, and then we also had a sniper kill team that was eventually called the wound team because this mission they shot some guy in the leg instead of taking him out. But these guys were working with an ODA team, so I'm pretty sure it's just a different type of soldier. I wish I had that. I had some really Afghan army guys. They were called Mohawks. That's what they called the Afghan special forces that later worked with us. So definitely a different change in attire. Yes, ma'am? I think so. And also the desertion rate is really high, and also drug use and everything. Well, I mean, where we were at, I mean, there was no running away. They were going to sit on this observation post. They were going to run missions. And talking about character, very, very, very brave individuals. We were rolling around in up-armored Humvees. Like I said, we were still having people hit. They were rolling around in Ford Rangers with flatbeds. No armor whatsoever. So definitely strong character, but as for discipline, there were a lot of disciplinary issues, especially hashish. You knew there was a group of Afghan National Army soldiers around when you could smell hash. That was a pretty quick way to see. And like I said, just kind of get into the photography part real quick. You know, I asked this gentleman, and I showed him a picture of my, at that time, ex-girlfriend. That's a funny story. And then he shows me, you know, probably pulls out a picture. We had no translators around us right there, but kind of pulls out a picture of his wallet of a brother or whatever. So I thought that was a pretty interesting detail. Nice picture. This one came out very nice on the wall. Thank you, Lynn. Yeah, this is on a remote outpost. They weren't going anywhere. They were not deserting. They weren't doing anything. They were sitting around drinking chai and just waiting for the next mission. Just waiting for the next mission.
Do you know how much these people
have? Say it, sir. That I have no clue, sir. I wish I had those numbers, sir. Now, I don't mean to call it enemy, Like, we didn't know, you know, who the insurgency were. Like, we weren't fighting the Taliban out there. We stepped in northeastern Afghanistan, the village of Kamdesh. We interrupted an illegal smuggling trade for lumber. We disrupted that first. We were about, I believe, I don't know, 5-9 miles from the Pakistan border. Basically, after that, you know, we had no clue who the enemy was. Just like Vietnam, there's no real set uniform. And basically how we passed off, in this case in particular, you know, we're over there. We have an aerial drone flying over there. They start seeing a wedge formation, and it turns out these guys were just going to shop. They just got done shopping. So there was no clear line on who was the enemy, who you were fighting. And I think we were fighting 5 different cells out there, not just the Taliban. I don't think we were even fighting against the Taliban. 5 different organizations that were trying to stop us from being there. And talking about the bases real quick, just kind of a photo I snapped. This is really early. A lot of these bases are built in centralized areas, especially this one in Jalalabad. And a lot of it's just farm community. You have this big military installation for the most part, and the outskirts are all farmland. They come up, they ask for biscuits and Pepsi and all sorts of things, and it's just this military installation just wrapped around, like I said, very rural areas. And it's kind of a nice picture. Yes, ma'am? I'm speaking at a very micro level with just a platoon, but please. That too, and then I've heard some wild stories, and especially I'm saying what the Army did for the cover-up, disgusting. Okay, I'm not going to go into that or my opinion on that. But as for an enemy, that's a completely situation. We're talking about combat. You're in a bad situation. People start shooting at you, and I don't really know the details on Pat Tillman, but it's just chaos. And you're just trying to make the best out of it. And trust me, you're not trying to kill, especially these guys being Army Rangers. We're talking about an elite unit right here, or job. You're not just infantry, you're an Army Ranger. So the different type of training, those guys are twice the soldier I was ever. You know, so that right there, that may have been just a bad day, a bad moment. And like I said, I personally don't know the details on it. This one I like right here. Like I said, I thought it was really interesting. Once we arrived, we established this base in a god-awful region. You know, we had no advantage whatsoever other than air power or mortars, all right? And during a helicopter resupply, this little kid is peering outside what used to be either a gun window or a top of like a turret window or a sight window for a Russian armored personnel carrier. Like I said, this is a park bench. They sit around. I think there's graffiti all over it, and it's just hollowed out steel or whatever skeleton. And this kid's just peering out of it, and just thought it was pretty interesting. And kind of getting to how I took the photo, and I was trying to go for candid photos. Hopefully I got the focus right, okay? And so I'm standing next to this kid. I'm pulling security, kind of take a knee real quick, and then hopefully I get the focus right, turn around, grab that photo. No, I'm just like right there. And that's what was pretty interesting, just trying to go for something that's candid. You know, even though he is looking at the camera, it just came out perfect, you know.
Did he run away after that?
I don't think so. I think, like I said, I showed the picture to him and started smiling. Another picture, you know, just me on the top of this observation post is another one of the contractors in that the contractor photo. And just right there, you know, there's this American soldier just trying to get that focus just right, trying to get that awesome portrait. You know, and they were completely open to it. Yes, ma'am?
Can I ask you a question about what you're going to do with
your picture? No. And they're probably just wondering what the heck I'm doing. And really, there was the language gap was, there was no way I could translate anything. It's just mainly just showing up in sign language. I mean, that really took me far. It's like, hey, you know, I kind of showed them the camera, started taking pictures, started getting comfortable with me. And probably after 10 minutes, you know, asked him if I could take this photo with, you know, sign language. And I flipped the camera around and he starts smiling, you know. So it's kind of a nice little detail with the behind the scenes. It's kind of this is when I was the reconnaissance photograph. There's Ridgeway over there, you know, aching from his, I think we did like a 6 or 8 hour march. Horrible terrain. This is in Konar Valley. So it's just horrible, like river rocks. So you're trying to get your footing, and then you got your gear on you and everything. And this little monkey's right next to me. So I was kind of, I don't know if it's getting scattered or not paying attention, but trying to grab these photos at the same, trying to keep my brain working, I guess. Like I said, kind of the culture right there. If you wanted something, say this is a cow that we ordered. Basically, they provide the cow, they butcher, and then they took all the good meat. And I think a bunch of people got sick after we ate that. And now this section right here, I'd like to talk about PTSD. This is pretty much like my focus right now with the Vet Center. And I want to go over the 45 minutes. So this right here is now Sergeant Sheldon, still in the military. And basically, this is a mission that I was back home in Tucson hanging out with old buddies, you know. And then I come back, and I start hearing these crazy stories of a 3-kilometer ambush. Oh, you know, Sergeant Sheldon called it an airstrike, all this other stuff. But actually hearing the real story, he was gunning, you know, right up here. He has his sights. Basically, he sees in the helmet was something completely different down in Kandahar. I think over a month period, I don't know how many firefights I got, but it was crazy. But he calls it an airstrike on a house, ends up killing a family along with the insurgents. So this right here, like I said, talking about PTSD, he was starting to break down in country, and I'm actually going to start giving some credit to the Army too in my next photo. And now this right here, just to give you an example of what this is. Now this is a 7.62 round. Now, like I said, when your armor in Afghanistan, you were only protected standing up to your ribs. So you squat down, you're protected to your head, you're able to gun, and you have your side part of your head protected. Now this is a bullet hitting that top piece of armor with Sergeant Sheldon, just inches from killing him. And then after that, no more. He wasn't doing missions. My platoon sergeant had to intervene, and they took him offline. So basically, he was put on like duty. He was answering radios. And actually kind of giving credit to the Army, we didn't have any Army psychologists where we were. At best, we had a chaplain. So for our NCOs and officers and to actually acknowledge that he's having a hard time, they respected that. They shifted him to somewhere else, you know. So I really do respect that. Yes, sir? I think, honestly, like PTSD is long term. You know, we have our World War II vets that are coming inside the Vet Center that are still suffering. They've been suffering for PTSD the last 60 plus years, never had it addressed. So what happens? Their marriage starts failing, substance abuse, how they treat their family, you know, whether extended or, you know, their wife, you know, anybody that's in that close knit, they're feeling the aftermath of that bullet. So right there, like I said, war's not good business at all. Not only is it expensive, but also the shock waves mental health-wise. This is me personally. But honestly, working in a mental health facility, I get to hear the stories. I have my own stories. You know, I could relate to it. You know, I was not in World War II, and you know, God bless those guys. But you know, it's long-term effects. You're not just going to recover from a bullet that just almost killed you. Or how are you going to weigh that fire mission that you called in and you killed a family? You know, luckily my eyes were censored. Yes, ma'am.
At the time that this happened, and your platoon mate or whatever starts to break down.
Yes, ma'am. I think, really, like I said, like looking at it, it was really interesting that they were actually intervening, even though they weren't psychologists or whatever. You know, they were actually intervening, getting him off the line platoon level, put him to light duty. Hopefully this gets him better. You know, that was pretty interesting. As for his peers, I didn't look back at him. Hearing the stories of him calling an airstrike on that house, you know, makes me think, you know, he had different responsibility than I did, and that's a price too. As for, you know, slamming him or making fun of him or anything like that, this guy right here, he had a personality, he would shoot back. You know, he had that personality, you know, so I would not say anything to him, first of all. But really, I mean, hey, he hit his breaking point in country, you know, so that was pretty interesting. So I personally would not. As for the chain of command, I have no clue. Hitting on living conditions, I believe this is when I kind of lead into this. This is us hitting the first snow of the year. This is after the Afghan Army soldier staring back at me and just continuing to take pictures, walking around, had my weapon, and making this journey, you know, trying to continue to tell a story. Now, I think this is the largest part that's just not being covered right here is the living conditions. This is down in southern Afghanistan, okay? And if anything, if I want you to leave here with anything, okay, it's the living conditions and actually knowing what these men and women are going through, all right? This is down in southern Afghanistan. You're going to hear a lot about it. Kandahar, Musa Kale, completely just desolate. It looks like it's Mars, okay? You have flatlands with moon dust like this. Every time you step up, just shoots a cloud. This is just one step. Just everything is caked in dirt, debris. Now you imagine having a convoy of 30 vehicles, what that does to your face when you're gunning, you know. And really, I'm going to hit with a few more photos, but really I want to take this one home.
Well, what else is going on out there with all that dust?
Well, that's, and then on top of that, you're battling an insurgency.
Yeah, no, but I mean, where are the Afghans? Is that just dead space for them?
Or? Yeah, pretty much, and it's all going towards a water source. You know, when I was out there for 72 hours, it was like 120 degrees. The only way we could cool down water that was with us was put it in a sock that was
moistened by the water,
and then the wind would hit that sock and cool down your water. So it's about improvising. I have a few good stories about that, but adapt and overcome. Now, this is my portion of contrast. When I was shooting, I was waiting to go on R&R. I'm down in Kandahar. And I walk into this PX, not PX, that was another story. This is the MWR. So you have your support side of the house, and then you have your combat arm soldiers, okay? And there's also the support network interwoven with the combat arm soldiers. So you have, I think this is a British or Aussie soldier, and, you know, karaoke night. And I just got in from this horrible mission, and these guys are having a good old time. And nothing against them, it takes the support section of the military to actually run the whole thing, so for the boots on the ground. Yes, sir?
In that context, so it used to be in the British military, and their alcohol was like rounds.
Okay.
U.S. military, do you not allow alcohol in Afghanistan, I believe?
No. That's General Order 1. This is it. This is as good as your life gets, unless you find... I'm not ragging on karaoke night at all. I was happy. I was drinking like a latte mocha at this thing called the Green Bean. I'm like, dude, yeah. No, it wasn't that. It was like a chocolate coffee milkshake. I'm like, this is awesome. Walking around my PTs just like this guy. I got a rifle on my back. I'm like, this is not bad. I mean, I chose the wrong job. You know, so, you know, and God bless these guys, like I said. But there's also that contrast. Okay, and I love this, and I tried to hang this one up. I kind of ran out of space. But these are actually kind of a white and blue. This is more, I don't know what color this is, you know. And this is the type of living conditions and the hardship that our guys are going through. And this is up in the mountains. So hopefully this doesn't fizz out on me. Turning yellow. Okay, well, hopefully we'll get through that. Give me 1 second. Okay. And this is, like I said, I want to bring this home. Like, our guys climbing up mountains, this is the first mission and only mission that I was sent back early. I'm not trying to play like I was, like, super Joe or anything like that. But this mission broke me off. I was a squad assault weapons, I guess, operator, climbing up this mountain, climbing on my hands and knees, and I was on the verge of tears after 3 days of climbing. Climbing this straight-up mountain, hopefully I don't fall off the side, you know. And this is the part of the... the team that got sick, and also myself heading back because I was broken off. I was so dehydrated the first day. I was sent down to grab a box of MREs. I couldn't even, so I threw the box of MREs. It hit a cliff face and rolled down 300 feet. And I was like crippled, like how dehydrated I was. I couldn't move. So they sent me back, the day after that. And so this is when we finally got power, which is pretty interesting. This is after 4 months about being at Camp Dish, and it was later renamed Camp Keating. And so this is our first exposure of getting a laptop, being able to charge our iPods from an actual power source instead of our power converter in our Humvees. And we actually got lighting, and then we started working on showers. You know, you're dealing with, like, everything that you knew back home, all the luxuries, just strip it away and then have to live in it within, you know, the next year. So as you got more things, you know, as you had hot showers eventually, that was amazing. Even having a shower, that was outstanding. So it slowly started to upgrade throughout the deployment. Kind of a nice self-portrait in there. It's my feet. It's like, how are you going to caption this one, you know? And another example, this is up on our observation post. So you had boxes of MREs put 2x2, and made the width of your body and the length of your body as well. That was your bed. The only comfortable part about it, you had a sleeping bag with you. That was your cushion. That was your your little bit of comfort. So this is after a dismounted mission. They came back after 3 hours trying to put this guy on a helicopter for R&R. You know, that was our mission. Get this guy back home, okay? So basically, you had one Potbelly stove, you had MREs, and we somehow had bean soup, which is pretty amazing. I'm like, where did this come from, you know? And that's as good as it got. This is us in an ammo can, of all things, I think boiling coffee. And it was just so, barbaric. But it was just so extreme, these living conditions, and it did get better. We were living in foxholes at a time for 4 months. You know, off and on for 2 week cycles, you know, but, you know, this is pretty much as good as it got up there. You know, and a few other points in leaving. This is the photo that pretty much got me the full access pass with my chain of command. And this is, like I said, when we had 10 personnel killed, 4 people from our squadron. And I respected his last moment saying goodbye to Lieutenant Colonel Fenty. Like I said, he had a ticket back home to see his newborn baby daughter. Instead, he tries to pull the guys off the mountain. The helicopter crashes. So, like I said, I mean, this whole thing, there's a lot of tragic stories. And this is my buddy that we went through basic training, duty station, deployment, and 19-year-old kid killed. And really how history will see people killed in accidents. That's also an interesting thing. At the memorial at Fort Drum, they have a listing of all the people killed in action by enemy fire. But where are these names at? They're gone. I almost offended. You know, where do these people's names sit in history? And I didn't see them on that placard at all for OEF-7. Yeah, that was. Yeah, I think I had like a longer exposure. Like I said, I think I was messing with auto setting or something like that. And this is a chaplain walking by. Yes, ma'am? Blue Force Dragons, yeah. We had that. They started bringing in acorns. We started bringing in new IED systems. The times that we were hit by IEDs, it was all dynamite. As for Blue Force trackers, that was our senior scouts that used them. So we had 2 Blue Force trackers. It's a computer system that you can navigate where you're going and everything. And we had 2 of those per platoon, so per 5 trucks. And like I said, to kind of conclude the photo essay, I was coming back. This is me after a long 15 months getting on a plane, leaving Afghanistan. Actually, I forgot the Air Force base we were at. So I don't think I got that photo out of a C-130. But just kind of finishing it. And that's pretty much the photo essay. I got a few other points I want to hit post-deployment. And like I said, I tried to keep myself busy. I started seeing stories, Army suicide. So I'm like, well, some guy, you know, and this is me being aggressive with photojournalism, guy cuts his wrist. I run out there and I try and take photos after he ran to the hospital, and a police officer, speaking about censorship, tried to erase my camera from me. She really didn't appreciate that. And going back to Westbrook and the resentment towards that, that's one thing that I have to kind of weigh also about looking at photojournalism long-term. You know, is it telling the story, or are you, you know, you kind of have your own agenda, you have your career, you have your own motivations. That's where it's kind of hard for me personally. And I shot stories, two stories on the border. I went to like a Nogales jail and also followed around the Border Patrol, and the connection wasn't there. But knowing him for almost 2 years and then he gets hit in front of me, it kind of changed that relationship between your subject matter and having that personal relationship. And that's the aftermath of his multiple surgeries. He was still going to Walter Reed, flying there and receiving surgeries. And this is kind of the aftermath of RPG. So he's out of the Army now. He was retired. And I believe he's back home in Louisville, Kentucky. And going back to my transition back to the student, it's not a normal student, you know, coming back from a war zone, transitioning, using the GI Bill. And, you know, like I was following in Afghanistan. All my buddies were following it. Dude, you hear, you know, we were talking on Facebook or still connecting over telephone. And my buddy sends me a link of this same gentleman on a Taliban video, propaganda video of the base they overran down in Camp Keating. So that year of my life, 15 months of the cavalry squadron that replaced us, and another year, I believe, from 4th ID that had those heavy casualties before they abandoned the base, and now it fell into enemy hands. And on top of that, it was being abandoned, first of all. There came the lives that were lost in between. And, you know, you really start to wonder for what? I mean, what was my personal contribution to this war? You know, and maybe it could be here tonight, me sharing photos. I don't know. But as for me, I mean, I don't know personally what I did that actually made a mark. Then, like I said, as soon as I came back, transitioning to school, I had a film crew from National Geographic sticking a boom mic over my head. And, you know, I'm telling you, it's been an amazing homecoming. And I'd like to end on that note. Thank you, everybody, for coming by. Thank you very much.